weeks.
Yes, said Church. It has.
What are you doing to find him?
Everything that we can.
Can I have a real answer instead of a pat one?
Junie, listen to me. I know you're scared, terrified. So are all his friends. But let me finish, said Church gently. We are looking. We have many of our allies looking. I have my entire network on the alert.
How do you even know he's alive? She demanded.
There was a pause. For the same reason you know that he is. We would know. Junie closed her eyes against the tears that wanted to fall, the tears that fell regardless.
Please, she said, find him. Help him.
Yes, said Church. Yes. Chapter 37. Lake Palestine, 10 miles southwest of Noonday, Texas. The two men who sat on the top of the picnic table looked like truckers. The taller of the two was a huge slab of a white guy with the sleeves cut off a threadbare denim jacket. His arms were packed with corded muscle and covered with Marine Corps tattoos. He wore jeans, scuffed work boots, and had a pair of mirrored sunglasses pushed high on his short blonde hair. He had a long scar slanting downward from above his left eyebrow, across the bridge of his nose and down to his right cheek. Both his canine teeth were gold, and the beer bottle clinked against one of them each time he took a sip. His companion was shorter and older, but no less rough-looking. A black man in his late 40s with a heavy silver chain around his neck, handcuff earrings, and a mouth that looked like he never smiled. His head was shaved, and he sported a Van Dyke style of goatee with the salt-and-pepper chin hair coming to a sharp point. He wore a Dallas Cowboys cap pulled low to shade his eyes and slowly chewed on an old kitchen match. Their fishing skiff was pulled up on the bank, rods sprouting like antennae, an old blue Coleman cooler resting in the boat. There were only a few fishermen left on the water. The news had said the bass were jumping, but no one seemed to be pulling many in. The February sun was hotter than it was supposed to be, and there wasn't a cloud in the sky.
"I ever tell you I hate fishing?"
asked the white man. The black man scratched his cheek.
"Today or ever?"
"Ever."
"Yeah, about 1,000 damn times."
"Well, it's true."
"So you keep saying."
They drank beer and watched the boats.
"It's boring as fuck."
"So is NASCAR," said the black man.
"I never said I liked NASCAR.
Wasn't asking if you did, farm boy. I was adding it to the list of boring sports."
"Golf, too, then," said the white man.
"Golf's okay. At least you get to walk. NASCAR is sitting on plastic chairs and drinking flat beer. Fishing is sitting in a boat and drinking warm beer."
"I like beer."
"Beer isn't the point."
They watched the boats.
"Volleyball's fun to watch,"
said the white man.
"You just like to watch girls playing volleyball."
"Women,"
corrected the younger man.
"Women,"
agreed the older man.
"And sure, what's not to like? All those buff women, tall too, jumping around in bikinis.
That's some grade-A sexist shit right there."
The white man thought about it.
"I guess. Don't know that I care. I mean about that part. If they were just women jumping around, it'd be all about boobs and buns, but that's a tough sport. I like the serious players."
"Uh-huh. And boobs and buns got nothing to do with it. Is that what you're trying to tell me?"
The white man shrugged.
"I'm not going to lie and say they don't, but if there's no skill, then it's just a meat rack."
"Uh-huh."
"No, oh, wait," said the white man, interrupting himself. "I think this is our guy."
They both turned to watch a blocky man walk toward them. He had Popeye forearms and a face like an eroded wall, and he wore jeans, boots, and a gray nylon windbreaker with a blue diamond symbol on the chest. A build cap with the same symbol was perched on his wiry red hair. He walked with purpose, his chest thrust out as if with a desire to smash the air itself out of his way. Then he slowed to a stop 10 feet away and studied the two fishermen with cold, appraising eyes. He pointed a finger at the younger man.
"Are you Redfield?"
"I'm Buck Redfield," said the white man, putting just a touch of belligerence in it. "Who's asking?"
The red-haired man smiled thinly.
"I'm the guy who needs you to tell me two little words."
That was the right signal, the opening of a code phrase exchange. The big man named Buck looked at his friend, who nodded.
"I'm Spartacus," said Buck, giving the proper response. "I'm Spartacus," said the black man.
"And what's the other thing?" asked the redhead.
"Azure Carbon," said the black man, completing the code.
The red-haired man's smile broadened, and some of the tension went out of his shoulders. He glanced at the older man.
"You're Guidry?"
"Marcus Guidry," agreed the black man. "People call me Guidry or G, and you are?"
"Randall Flagg."
"Real name?"
Flagg snorted, but didn't answer. Instead, he glanced at the boat pulled up on the dirt.
"You catch anything?"
Buck shrugged. "A light beer buzz and 10 million motherfucking mosquito bites."
Flagg nodded.
"We checked you out. Interesting service records. Good in a fight. The right training, lots of experience, but a little trouble here and there. Buck, you got kicked out of the Marines, got caught running a sideline in military gear. And Guidry, you retired from the Army before they could retire you for fucking the wrong officer's daughter."
"She was of age,"
said Guidry, and he punctuated it by spitting over the far end of the picnic table, getting good distance and velocity and without losing his kitchen match.
"What about it?" asked Buck. "You going to lecture us on good behavior?"
Flagg's smile remained in place, but there was a calculating look in his eyes.
"You're here because you're looking to sign on with the people I represent," he said. "We're a bit more, and I hate to use this word, liberal in our views about what a man does in his free time. Same for when a man sees an opportunity and wants to make a buck off it."
They said nothing.
"But here's the thing," said Flagg. "All of that is okay when you're off the clock, but when you're on the clock, then you don't break any of the Haas rules. You keep it zipped, and you don't so much as pick up a tarnished penny that isn't yours. That has to be understood and agreed to, or you fellas can go back to fishing."
Guidry took the matchstick out and considered the gnawed end, then put it into the other corner of his mouth.
"I really fucking hate fishing,"
he said. Flagg glanced at Buck.
"Hell, I hate bass fishing most of all," said the big man.
They all grinned at that. Flagg looked around at the 30 or so pickup trucks parked behind them.
"Which one's yours?"
"Piece of shit blue old Ford yonder," said Guidry.
"You gassed up?"
"Mostly," said Buck. "3/4 of a tank."
"That'll do," said Flagg.
He pointed to a sleek black GMC Terrain, the current year's model.
"That's mine. Follow me."
"Where are we going?" asked Guidry.
"Just follow."
With that, Randall Flagg walked back to his car, got in, started the engine, and waited. Buck and Guidry exchanged a look, picked up their gear, returned the rental boat, and climbed into their truck. Buck drove, following the SUV onto Route 49, heading north. Once they were on the road, Guidry tapped a small mole near his left ear.
"You get all that bug?"
he asked.
"Got all of it, Pappy," said a younger voice.
Both men wore similar tiny earbuds that were designed to fade into the landscape of their complexion and skin type.
"You get a read on him?"
"Well," said Bug, "he sure isn't Randall Flagg. That's the bad guy from The Stand. Old Stephen King book about..."
"I read it. Who's the guy?"
"I pulled his image from the cameras in your shirt button and ran it through facial recognition. Someone tried real hard to erase him from the net."
"But..."
"But this is me."
"Stop bragging, Bug," said Guidry. "Who is he?"
"John Andrew Saxon," said Bug. "He was a lieutenant in the Air Force, opted out in 2012. Minor league asshole, 4 ex-wives and several domestic violence complaints. No charges because the women seemed unwilling to testify. Might have been involved in a gang rape in Iraq, but there's a reference to a written statement that isn't uploaded to any military database. Whatever it was, they squashed the charges and expunged most of Saxon's computer records.
Mind Reader Q1's able to gather scraps from fragments left online and some data scars. It's not much. Bottom line is that he's a total prick, and that makes him the poster boy for what he does now. Talent scout for the PMC biz. Been on the Blue Diamond security payroll for 9 years.
And?
Prompted Guidry. And he's on our list as a possible recruiter for Kuga.
He's a fixer? Asked Buck.
Nah, just a scout. He's exactly who we needed to find, though, and my guess is he's taking you to either a meeting with someone higher up the food chain or maybe to a camp. I've got buzzard drones in the air tracking you. Just ease back and enjoy the ride.
Copy that.
The blonde young man flipped his sunglasses down and cruised along 50 feet behind the SUV.
Bug,
asked Bunny,
we have any word on Outlaw?
There was a lag before Bug answered.
He's still out there. We're still looking.
That was all he'd say, but it was enough.
Copy that,
said Top. They settled back as the miles burned away under their tires. Chapter 38. Florence, Italy. The man came awake while walking. That's how it felt. He had been lost in a nightmare of flight and pursuit, and in that dream, he had been both predator and prey. Now he was awake, walking down a street. He looked around, completely unsure of where he was. The street signs and store names were in Italian, but how? He fought for memories, found a few swimming away from him in the darkness of his thoughts, grabbed at them, caught one or two. His last clear memory was of the burning building in Johannesburg. Was that a real memory? Were the things he remembered true? God help me, he whispered, choking on the words, praying that none of those memories belonged to him. Knowing, though, that they did. There were too many details for it to be something borrowed from a movie or book, and too vivid, with all five senses horribly engaged, for them to be residue from a dream. Dr. Gerald Engelbrecht, the guards and the staff, the fires. He looked down at his hands, surprised to realize that they were gripping suitcases, heavy ones, cases he did not recognize. Saw his dog looking up at him. Ghost looked strange. Wrong. Older, thinner, hungrier in bad ways. The emotional support animal vest he wore was like a bad joke. How could any animal support him emotionally? He was miles past being a train wreck on any emotional level, and as for his soul. He looked around, saw a bench across the street, and carried the cases over, laid them on the seat, opened each. Both were crammed with file folders, flash drives, cell phones, and hard drives. Some of the papers were singed. Some were spattered with blood. How the hell did he ever get them through customs? He fished for that knowledge, but there was nothing there, just a vast black wall without window or door, impenetrable, immutable. Please, he said, but to whom? And for what? Beside him, the dog whined. He closed the cases and sat down, patting his pockets for something to feed the animal, found nothing. There was a wallet, though, stuffed with currency from 4 different countries, plenty of euros. The photo ID was his face, but the name was different. Kurt Grobler. The man stood up slowly, took several long breaths, and then picked up the cases. He walked and walked until he found a convenience store. In there, on a local paper, he discovered that he was in Florence. There were cans of dog food on a shelf, and he bought a dozen, as well as every kind of treat he could find. He paid for it, asked where he could find a cab, and took the taxi to the Hotel Bernini Palace on the Piazza di San Firenze. Big hotels were easier to become lost in, fewer people noticed, and they allowed service animals.
Once he was inside his room, he fed Ghost, ordered room service, went into the bathroom to shower, and was gone again before the water even hit his skin. Chapter 39 Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece.
Explain to me what it is you're doing. Scott Wilson pulled up a chair and sat next to Bug.
He'd brought a peace offering of a quadruple shot espresso with four Red Bull pumps and topped with chocolate whip and mocha sprinkles made special by the RTI barista, Mustafa. Wilson had winced while watching the drink being made because there was enough caffeine in there to give a coronary to a bronze statue of Atlas. It was known around Phoenix House as Bug's Chug. Wilson watched Bug sip and sigh. The RTI's chief of operations sipped from a cup of green tea with a drop of alfalfa honey.
"Which part of what I'm doing do you need explained?" asked Bug, dabbing at foam on his upper lip.
"You know what I mean," said Wilson mildly.
He was a short and very thin man who, to a casual stranger, looked like someone wasted by sickness. That was deceptive, though, because he was actually very fit, slender, and wiry. With his quiet business suits, striped club tie, pocket square, and thinning medium brown hair brushed straight back, he looked like a merchant banker, or perhaps an estate lawyer for old money. Wilson had exceptionally pale skin and ice-blue eyes, both of which gave him a somewhat washed-out look. His Eton accent was precise and clipped, and his smile often looked more like a wince. Bug, although about the same height and only a few pounds heavier, was his polar opposite. He had medium brown skin, black hair in dozens of braids, very thick glasses with heavy purple frames, a rather hopeful attempt at a beard that refused to look authoritative, and an earring fashioned to look like a hatchet stuck in the lobe. He wore a Wakanda Olympic bobsled team t-shirt, jeans that were so ancient it was impossible to tell the brand or original color, and flip-flops. The walls of his office were lined with shelves on which were hundreds of very rare and lovingly preserved superhero action figures, most in their original unopened packaging, the newest editions of which were the Marvel Legends, Silver Shirt Luke Cage and Crimson Dawn Psylocke. There were also framed shots of Bug with Chadwick Boseman, Stan Lee, Lupita Nyong'o, and Danai Gurira. Wilson, a very patient man, waited for Bug to decide how to answer.
"It's authorized by the big man," said Bug.
"Fair enough," said Wilson. "But what is it?"
Bug grinned.
"I'm doing to Kuga's online presence what the Visigoths did to Rome. I rather assumed that. Please give me some details."
"You ask Church about this?"
Wilson smiled.
"He said to ask you."
Ah, indeed.
Bug looked at the specialty drink, smiled, picked up a blue Sharpie, and wrote "attempted bribery" on the cup, sipped and set it down with the words turned toward Wilson.
"Okay," he said. "So we know Joe is out there doing some damage to the Kuga Labs, right?"
"We do."
"He's hurting their R&D and taking some very bad people off the checkerboard, apparently,"
agreed Wilson.
"I can't help with that," said Bug. "Not directly, anyway. So instead of sitting here doing nothing and going slowly out of my mind, I decided to see what kind of fun I could have with Kuga's network online."
"And by fun, you mean?"
"Maybe it's better if you don't know."
Wilson's smile looked like thin plastic.
"Tell me anyway," he said.
"You won't like it," said Bug. "Would you like a comprehensive list of all the things I haven't liked recently?"
"Not really.
Just tell me,"
said Wilson.
"With details or the highlights?" "Let's start with the highlights."
"Sure. Well, we know that Kuga has some hotshots on the cyber warfare team, cyber espionage team, and cyber terrorism team."
"You think they're separate teams?"
"Sure. Maybe with some crossovers, but it's easy enough to see that their online strategies operate according to different philosophies. Maybe there's one or two guys overseeing it, but the actual attacks are all over the place. You see, they've been going after their competitors with sophisticated attacks going back a few years. I mean,
before Harcourt Bolton was sprung from that black site prison, which means he had infrastructure in place to run that part of things. That means Kuga not only had people already in place, but whoever was in charge of that division knew how to pick top talent. When I realized that, I put some of my people on it, mostly looking for known or suspected top-tier black hat or black-leaning gray hat hackers who have either vanished recently or who've gotten rich. Did you find any? Sure. The one thing about the kind of hacker who specializes in this stuff is that a lot of them are young and they have egos. They want to be known for what they've done. They tag it, usually by working some kind of smart-ass code into whatever software they wrote to do the intended damage. What kind of damage? Asked Wilson. And who are the targets? Well, before Ohan was killed, his network had been thoroughly hacked. Dissected, really. We've acquired enough of his laptops, external drives, and even one mainframe, thanks to Arclight, and those files are riddled with malware. Those are applications designed to perform a variety of very malicious tasks. All kinds, too, and my bug hunter guys were able to isolate each. There were malware strains designed to create persistent access to a network which allowed Kuga to spy on Ohan's day-to-day business operations. Other malware was planted to clone IDs, passwords, and the kind of encryption coding used to hide numbered bank accounts. We found these little bits of code left in the system, hidden inside Trojan horses that pinged Kuga every time a transaction was made above a certain dollar amount. Kuga was able to review the purchases, which is how, I'm guessing, he was able to know which products and product lines were selling for top dollar, what the swings in sales numbers were, and who was buying the stuff. Clever. Very. And that code is a real bitch to find. Maybe two or three of the world's top cybersecurity companies or groups could have found it, but then again, maybe not. But you found it, said Wilson, not quite making it a question. Bug sipped his drink and didn't comment on that. We also found spyware that was so thoroughly wired into Ohan's personnel records and business contacts that it gave Kuga a great laundry list for recruitment. Kuga's team was siphoning off people from Ohan even before Arclight killed him, and within 2 hours of Ohan's body being discovered by police, Kuga had his human resources people out there scooping up the rest of the top talent. Very smooth, which tells me that it was something set in place for just such an event. How is this you being a Visigoth? I'm getting there, said Bug. Kuga's people also did a massive amount of phishing attacks, using all kinds of tricks to get Ohan's customers to hand over valuable information, such as passwords, credit card details, intellectual property, and so on. That worked so well because no one but Ohan was ever supposed to have the email addresses used in that level of black market sales. The fact that they were receiving emails at all made them appear legit, which, by the way, is stupid. People are stupid. Most people should never be allowed anywhere near a computer or email or the internet. You're preaching rather than explaining, said Wilson, sipping his tea and privately regretting having asked. He wished it were cognac in the cup instead. But Bug was clearly getting into gear. He went through a whole slate of other kinds of attacks. There's the MITM stuff, said Bug with real enthusiasm. That stands for man in the middle, which is where the attacker intercepts communications between two parties in an attempt to spy on the victims, steal personal information or credentials, or perhaps alter the conversation in some way. Now, you might try to tell me that MITM is old stuff and that end-to-end email and chat encryption prevents that kind of thing, but you'd be wrong.
I wouldn't dare suggest such a thing, said Wilson faintly.
MITM has undergone a lot of upgrades and at worst looks like tech support messages from the internet or email provider.
I see, said Wilson, who barely did.
What's a bit more dangerous are DDoS attacks, where the bad guys flood a target server with traffic in an attempt to disrupt and perhaps even bring down the target. And I'm not talking some pansy denial of service attacks here, because most sophisticated firewalls kick their asses pretty easily these days. But super programs that can hit multiple compromised devices belonging to the target and bombard them with traffic. We're talking tens of thousands of emails, robocalls, text messages, and even social media posts. The target is
buried and has to abandon their email addresses, domain names, and stuff like that. Kuga's people usually hit them with political stuff from the opposing parties or using the go-to they all like, filling the inboxes and chats with kiddie porn, then dropping dimes to whichever law enforcement agency has jurisdiction. It's almost impossible to prove that the kiddie porn was planted, and by then, reputations are shot, jobs lost, security clearances removed, and lives destroyed.
Ugly, but I can see how it would be effective.
One of Kuga's favorite tricks is zero-day exploiting. They are clearly following R&D on the latest business and e-commerce software. Like, when a new software-driven product launches, they slip in code to screw it up or totally hijack it. That's bad enough for the good guys, but when they hit a major company doing some off-book shady stuff, like maybe doing backdoor deals with bad actors among the more negative foreign governments, then that company has to pay up or they'll lose more than business. Or if Kuga wants to screw up the flow of business, he has his people look for some vulnerability in the software, and there's usually something, and then do as much damage as possible until a fix is found.
That sounds nasty, but useful.
Bugs sniffed. It's okay. Not enough companies and organizations monitor for this, and done right, it creates a tunnel through a firewall. That's a nice pipeline for introducing malware or other fun stuff.
Wilson sat back and listened as Bug went on and on about the different types of cyber attacks, including business email compromises, cryptojacking, drive-by attacks, cross-site scripting attacks, password attacks, eavesdropping attacks, AI-powered attacks, and IoT-based attacks. By the time Bug was finished, the chief of operations was somewhat dazed. He got to his feet, patted Bug on the back, mumbled,
"Jolly good, keep up the good work,"
and shambled out. He was back in his own office before he realized Bug never actually answered his question about what he was doing. But Wilson did not dare go back downstairs for another round. Chapter 40. Civitella in Val di Chiana, Arezzo, Tuscany, Italy. Alexander Fong crouched behind his desk and listened to the gunfire and the screams. So much gunfire, so many screams, but now less of each. He had a gun of his own, but it was a little 25 automatic that he'd only ever fired once and then badly, missing the paper target with 4 of the 6 bullets in the magazine. The 2 that hit the paper missed anything of value. As for screams, he had plenty of those. They were still bottled up inside him, ready to be let out if whoever was killing his people got through his office door. That seemed likely. Fong wondered if he should simply put the barrel of the little Raven Arms pistol under his chin and pull the trigger. Would it work, though? He'd heard stories about people missing. Or maybe that wasn't the right way to phrase it, missing the right part of the brain, the part that would switch the brain off forever. Last thing Fong wanted was to be a cripple or a vegetable. The gunfire paused for a moment. Fong listened, praying that his people had managed to cut the invaders down. He had no idea how many there were. He'd only caught a glimpse of one man, big, dressed in body armor and wearing a helmet and balaclava, a man who moved like a soldier. There was a dog, too, also armored. They had torn into a group of Fong's administrative assistants. In the 4 seconds he'd watched, the carnage was terrible, like nothing he'd ever seen. Fong was so far removed from anything his employers did that all he ever got to see was the sanitized versions on the news. Sure, he'd heard stories, and some of them were extreme to the point of grotesque absurdity, but that was different from actually seeing it. Those stories were abstractions. What he'd seen in the foyer of the administrative suite was brutally real. He was aware of the historical irony of what was happening. His direct supervisor, Rafael Santoro, had chosen this building because it was in the square, outside, that Hermann Göring's Nazis massacred 244 civilians from this town in retaliation for the killing of 2 German soldiers. Except the townsfolk were innocent. The killings had been done by partisans. The slaughter in the town square way back in June of 1944 had had the opposite effect of what Göring intended. Instead of cowing the civilians, it had sparked an increase in guerrilla activity and gave the Germans no real peace. when the war ended, any surviving Germans were hunted and torn apart. Santoro held that up as an example of how not to manipulate people into cooperation. Fear of what might happen was always more effective than having martyrs to rally the passion of resistance. Was irony the right word? Maybe it was karma, or something. It was hard to structure his thoughts. The pistol felt like a toy in his hand. Stupid little gun. Weren't these things supposed to make him feel strong? The silence outside seemed to stretch. All he could hear now were the cries of crows and ravens. The birds seemed to be everywhere these days. He hated them. They touched some unspecified and atavistic dread buried deep beneath the surface of his introspection. But why wasn't anyone yelling anymore? Fong hid where he was, not daring to even peek out from behind his desk. His hands were sweaty, and he was afraid that if he had to shoot, the gun would just slip out. Then there was a sound. Not a scream, not a gunshot, not the creak of an opening door. It was a growl. And it was right above him. Fong raised his head slowly and stared up, amazed, dumbfounded, terrified. There, crouched on top of the very desk behind which he cowered, was the dog. Big, white except for its muzzle, which glistened with an awful, dreadful crimson. The animal bared its teeth. Those teeth. Some were dog teeth, the others. They were metal, pasted with red, 20 inches from his face. Fong fumbled with the pistol, trying to bring it up, uncertain if he'd racked the slide. Was there even a bullet in the chamber? God, he couldn't remember. A shadow fell across him, and he turned to see that the man was here too. Both of them had come into his office without making a sound. The gun in the man's hand was big and ugly, and it was pointed at him. Chapter 41. Blue Diamond Training Camp, Caddo Mills, Texas. They called it a camp, but it was really a gymnasium, part of a middle school that had been closed due to redistricting and budget shortfalls. The windows were all sealed and blocked, and there was a stout metal security fence around the perimeter, with a guard station at the entrance and regular foot patrols. Bunny pulled the old Ford into a slot next to the GMC, and they got out, waiting as Saxon finished a call inside his car. Then he got out, still smiling. He was a smiler, that one, and Top Sims didn't like the smile at all. It was the kind of smile alligators wore right up until they took a bite out of you. There was nothing at all trustworthy in that grin, as if he knew no one trusted him and wanted to assure them that they shouldn't. Top thought about how much fun it would be to bust out every one of Saxon's flawless teeth and maybe knock the lantern firmness out of his jaw, maybe kick his balls up into his chest cavity for good measure. But all that was unlikely, since Saxon was a low-level talent scout and messing him up would endanger the mission. Fun to think about, though.
"So what's the play here, Flag?"
he asked Saxon.
"Let's go see," said Saxon vaguely. He paused. "You boys carrying?"
Top and Bunny hesitated, as if surprised by the question. Bunny gestured to his ankle.
"Got a Colt Mustang XSP," he said.
Top half turned and raised his shirt to reveal a Glock 9mm in a belt holster.
"You'll need to check those at the door," said Saxon. "Rules."
"Not a big fan of giving my gun up to anyone," said Bunny, putting some bluster into it.
"And you can drive your ass out of here whenever you want, son," said Saxon. "No one's stopping you. But if you want to come in and talk to the man, then you got to check your guns at the door. Your choice."
Top contrived to look pained and then nodded.
"It's cool, Buck. House rules."
"House rules,"
agreed Saxon.
"Fuck,"
said Bunny. But he bent and removed the holstered piece. Instead of handing it over, he went around and unlocked a heavy steel box in the bed of the Ford and stowed his pistol in there.
"This work for you, Hoss?"
he asked.
"That's fine," said Saxon.
Top pulled the holstered Glock from his belt and handed it to Bunny, who locked the box. "And neither of you boys will object to a metal detector and a pat-down," said Saxon, not really making it a question.
"Yeah, sure, whatever,"
said Bunny. They followed Saxon into the gymnasium, which was a huge cinderblock structure attached to the back of the school building. There were armed guards at the door and another pair inside, flanking a good-quality metal detector.
"New recruits, Mr. Saxon?"
asked one guard. Top contrived to look surprised.
"Saxon?"
The talent scout spread his hands.
"Yeah, well, John Saxon in here, Randall Flag out there, capiche?"
"It's copacetic," said Bunny. "Flag's like your combat call sign."
"Sure," said Saxon. "Like that."
He gestured to the metal detector.
"Shall we?"
It beeped once, requiring that Bunny remove his belt, which had a heavy steel buckle, and once inside, a moon-faced guard patted them down. He was very thorough.
"You done stroking my dick?"
asked Bunny.
"Nah, couldn't find it," said the guard, which knocked a genuine laugh from Top.
The guard straightened. "They're clean." Top and Bunny followed Saxon toward the building. They were unarmed and greatly outnumbered. It was not the first time they'd been in something this tight, but previous experience and the memory of how some of those other situations played out did not inspire a single ounce of confidence that they were either safe or secure.
Chapter 42. Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. Church and Lilith sat together, though they were not on the same continent. She was in an Arclight safe house in a quiet suburb of Johannesburg, and he was in his office at the RTI headquarters. The illusion was created by the Orb, the Operational Resource Bay, which was one of Doc Holliday's inventions. Dozens of small cameras worked in sync to use a proprietary imaging tech to put holograms of them both into a shared space. It looked like they were seated together on a bench in Dobrenti Square in Budapest on a quiet evening. The Orb even added ambient noise of nearby traffic, birdsong, and laughter, but muted. Lilith was amused.
"Here, of all places, since when are you sentimental?"
He smiled faintly.
"I often come here."
"Not really,"
she chided.
"Not really, but the Orb allows me to mix business with pleasure."
She smiled and shook her head.
"Saint-Germain, mooning over where we had our first kiss."
"Behave," he said.
They smiled at each other, and he saw the small movement as she very nearly reached out to try and take his hand, but stopped herself, because that was beyond even the Orb's capabilities. Then she asked,
"Do they know?"
"Bug knows, of course. He's known since the beginning."
"Who else?"
"Scott Wilson suspects, and as long as it's only a suspicion, I'm not burdened by the weight of his disapproval."
"What about Rudy Sanchez?"
"We've had talks about Ledger. Diagnosis and prognosis. I shared with him the psych eval from the profiler Wilson put on it. Rudy's conclusion was that it was a very well-written, well-considered piece of garbage."
"I read it too, and Sanchez is quite correct."
"It's not entirely without merit," said Church, though he didn't push the issue. In truth, he found it to be pedestrian.
Wilson had wanted an objective opinion from a top forensic psychologist, but applying standard models, even models of known psychological deviations, to Joe Ledger was a waste of time and resources. But Wilson was as concerned and as frustrated as everyone else, and approving the report was something he could at least do.
"Will you tell Junie?"
"No," he said, "not until we know more. Right now, all we've been able to do is lift the crime scene reports from whichever agency has jurisdiction. And we've received uploads of data, but all the data transfer is from sites like internet cafes or coffee shops with no camera surveillance. Some materials were left in airport lockers. No collectible forensics of any kind."
"Ledger knows his tradecraft, I'll give him that,"
said Lilith.
"Bug has done a lot of searching for real estate rentals and hotels, and he believes
Ledger is using the Bucharest model.
Smart, she said.
The Bucharest model was a technique established during the Cold War but greatly refined since. A person with the right resources would use several different credit cards to book different rooms in the same hotel. He would check in to each using a variety of disguises. Sometimes Confederates were employed for this purpose, but Ledger was almost certainly acting alone. Each room would serve a different purpose: equipment storage, bolt hole, or actual lodging. Since modern hotels no longer required returning key cards to the desk, there was little way to track the movements of guests until the cleaning staff knocked on the door after checkout time. It was complicated, but the extra steps made it virtually impossible to find someone. And the upper-tier pros often went the extra mile to check into more than one hotel. With Ledger's high-end talent for languages and regional accents, becoming invisible was easy. The complication for him was ghost, but somehow Ledger managed. Bug had logged 8 different combinations of tall men with large dogs, though the color of the dog's hair and the stated purpose, guide dog or different levels of emotional support, raised no particular eyebrows. Except to Bug. And there were also safe houses, attached to various organizations, some of which were left empty. Someone with RTI-level equipment could game any monitoring devices, however. Ledger used 2 sets of identities to obtain field kits from 2 different in-country resources, said Church. With those, he can stay off the grid for as long as he wants. And we've determined that he used a lightning bug to kill his and Ghost's RFID chips. Lilith grunted.
He and his dog are both ghosts.
Yes, said Church. Which is why I asked you to meet me. What have your people found?
We may be getting close, she said, or at least closer. After the first few hits here in South Africa, we were able to make an educated guess as to who he was going to target next. We know he's been going after people of 2 kinds. Scientists who have been on lists of people with possible or likely ties to Cougar operations, and people in the technologies and terrorism arms of the black market who used to work for Ohan.
Ledger was very familiar with Ohan's operation, said Church. We were building a mission profile to go after him, but...
But Arclight got there first. No apologies, Saint-Germain.
None needed. My point is that Ledger is well-versed on those names.
There are people on both of my lists, tech and sales, who are in morgues all over this part of the country. We got to one in the hospital, though. Well, let me rephrase that. We hijacked the ambulance taking him to a hospital. He's now in a landfill.
He talked? Asked Church.
Oh, yes. He gave us a very accurate physical description, though the attacker wore a balaclava. Right size and build, right description of how he moved, and the attacker had a white combat dog in next-gen body armor. The dog had metal teeth.
Ah. And what did this unfortunate person have to say?
He admitted that he gave Ledger some names. We're staking out those places now.
What was this man involved in?
That's the odd part, said Lilith. He was rambling a bit, screaming, really. And he kept referring to 2 things, some kind of drug or drug treatment called R-33, and some upcoming event he knew only as the American Operation.
Did he have any details about what this American Operation might be?
Nothing specific, alas, she said. But he said it was, and I quote, what we're all working on. We've been wondering what Cougar's next big play is going to be, and I think this is our first true whiff.
Chapter 43. Civitella in Val di Chiana, Arezzo, Tuscany, Italy. The man sat on a bench in a park on a street he couldn't name. The park was in shadows except for a few lights along the wandering stone pathway. The man's dog lay on the bench with his head on the man's lap. They'd been like that for more than 2 hours. The man watched nothing. His eyes were out of focus. The world was a gray-green blur of inconsequential colors.
his fingers flexed open and closed, massaging the ruff of the dog's neck. He did not remember washing the blood off his hand, or off the dog's coat, for that matter. He didn't remember changing back into civilian clothes. So many things lately were blurred out of his consciousness. He knew he should be afraid of that he was certain. When a voice spoke behind him, the man snapped to full awareness, but he did not turn around.
"I have to say, Joey," said the voice, "I'm getting worried about how you're handling things."
The voice was warm, mature, and familiar, so familiar.
"You're leaning way out over that edge, son."
"Go away," said the man.
"I already went away. You know that, Joey."
"Don't call me that.
It's your name.
That's what you called me when I was a little kid." The man chuckled softly.
"Well, you're always going to be my little boy, Joey, always and forever.
You're not real.
And yet here you are talking to me."
Go ahead, take your time.
Say what you need to say."
"There's something wrong with me."
"Joey, there's been something wrong with you since you were 14. After what happened to you and that poor girl, of course there's something wrong with you. They broke you, son. They broke your bones, and they broke your heart, and they broke your head."
"Why are you doing this?" the man demanded, though he still did not turn around.
"Because I love you, Joey. Always have, always will. And I'm scared for you. You're not right. And I think you know that."
"Leave me alone," begged the man. "Please."
The big white shepherd woke up and raised his head. He looked over the back of the bench, and for a moment his bushy tail wagged back and forth. Then the man felt a breath on his ear as if the person behind him had leaned close. He squeezed his eyes shut. The breath was cold and damp and smelled of rotting things.
"The darkness never forgives," said the voice, "and it never forgets. It has almost all of you now, and if you're not careful, son, it's going to swallow you whole."
The man got to his feet and turned. "Dad, please!" But there was no one standing behind him. The trees in the park were crowded with nightbirds, though, thousands of them like a cloud of shadows, watching with their bottomless black eyes. The man sank slowly down onto the bench and put his face in his hands. Chapter 44. Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. Bug was not naturally a vindictive person. It took some effort for him to be mean, but he could get into gear when he tried. When Mr. Church suggested that he go after the hackers working for Kuga and to make it hurt, that came with a great deal of license and a tremendous reach, and Mind Reader Q1 gave that reach a lot of punch. He locked his office, turned on some late 1990s dubstep, dragged his cooler of Red Bull to within easy grabbing range, tore open a 1-pound bag of Twizzlers, and set to work. The first thing he did was dive into some bookmarks he'd created, especially for darknet market sites that were supposed to be accessed only by special encrypted invitation. Over the years, Bug had created scores of online personalities, including one as the highly respected and highly feared hacker, Coal Tiger, named for Stan Lee and Jack Kirby's original and unfortunate name for the comic book character who later became the Black Panther. As Coal Tiger, he was admitted to chat rooms that would otherwise have been sealed shut against him. In those chats, computer experts who worked for the black marketeers using the dark net got together to, among other things, brag. Hackers loved to brag, though they typically hid behind obfuscatory walls, false identities, and location rerouters. They were by nature and necessity an exceptionally paranoid bunch. One error, and they could invite their own competition inside their online fortresses of solitude. There were several hundred of these chat rooms, though most were posers who wanted to be seen as top-level black hats without actually having the chops. But the key players, a group of less than 100 worldwide, were the kings of the Matrix. Most of their chat rooms were located on Tor or I2P, premier darknets for black market vendors selling or brokering large quantities of drugs, weapons, all manner of physical and cryptocurrencies, unlicensed pharmaceuticals, hijacked credit card information, passwords, weapons of every kind, old Soviet-era military technology, and slaves. Sex trafficking was huge on the darknet, and because the sites could not be found via any kind of standard search engine, the flow of business was seldom interrupted. The hackers remained aloof and apart, like an extended family of trickster gods: Loki, Coyote, Raven Spirits, Wakjunga, Anansi, and others. Bug had variations on his darknet identities. He was Coal Tiger and the Fisher King. He was Big Bad Boy and Punji, and others, identities he created, cultivated, and left on the net, touching them up every now and then to keep them fresh and active. Some of his online avatars were actually repurposed from hackers the DMS and RTI had taken down. It was as the Fisher King, though, that he went on a buying spree. He put feelers out that he was looking for cybernetic implants, neurochips, and cutting-edge eugeroics for wakefulness. Bug was very careful reaching out, making sure he did it from obscure angles and never, never, ever appearing too eager or too desperate. He found that the B&B approach worked best, bitching and bargaining, complaining about the sale price for something and then haggling like a carpet merchant. Eagerness was either the sign of a rookie or, most often on the darknet, an indication that he was a cop of some kind. It took weeks to get into the right position, and each day he'd repeat the same ritual of ultra-caffeination and sugar rush, which brought him to that elevated state of hyper-awareness and quickness of thought. The trick was to intersperse the sugars with proteins and fats so that he didn't crash. Each time he made contact with someone promising, Bug used Mind Reader Q1 to send a Trojan horse back to whomever emailed or messaged him a quote. Most of the very top hackers believed that they were immune to those kinds of intrusions, and they had software to review every line of code in the metadata of that email. Except Mind Reader's quantum speed was too fast to be caught. As soon as a connection was made by receiving the email or message, it attacked without using a reply message at all. This was something Bug developed years ago for Mr. Church. The super intrusion software swept into the sender's system via their own email and positioned itself to make the target unable to read any of the Trojan horse code. It wouldn't even see that it was there, no matter which kind of cybersecurity tools were used. Long ago, Bug and Church had discussed sharing this software. The pro side of the argument was that it would greatly protect the military, universities, hospitals, and the computers running the power grids. Though, while that was true, sharing it was greatly outweighed by the cons of it simply being too dangerous. If the tech got out, then there would be no protection for anyone. The compromise was that Bug went into the systems running nuclear power, electrical grids, and a few key places, and planted a different set of Trojan horses, a set of analytical and reactive programs designed to prevent the most sophisticated and dangerous kinds of black hat hacking. They called it Operation Counterpunch, and only the two of them were aware that it existed. Bug was not in a mood to send benign, protective viruses out there, however. He was hunting for links in the Kuga chain of black market experts, and although he had not yet found the main Kuga online presence, he had a serious in. A bit less than 2 years ago, one of Lilith's Arclight teams had captured, interrogated, and executed the man who had been, to that point, the most successful and powerful black marketeer of all time, the Turk named Ohan. Before he died, and he died very badly, Lilith's team extracted a great deal of information from him.
They were on the hunt for key players in the sex trafficking world, and they found many. Found and removed in very ugly ways. However, the byproducts of all that were what Lilith considered scraps. Names, email addresses, passwords, and darknet sites for nearly 40 of Ohan's top people who had been recruited by Kuga. In a sane and smart world, all those people would have erased their previous online identities and created new and antiseptic ones. However, as most cops in the world know, few criminals are masterminds. Even those who hired brilliant black hats to advise them still did profoundly stupid things, like keep old email accounts to communicate with friends, or maintain back-channel lines of communication, thinking that those were, by their nature, safe. Bug loved that kind of thing. A window only needed to be opened a crack for him to get in. And each day he worked at Mr. Church's project, he did more damage. He shared crucial information with competitors and outright enemies. He planted unbreakable ransomware on banking systems working with these people. He outed them as pedophiles, even when they weren't, to the right media sources. He stole billions in funds and donated it to charities. He crashed expensive systems on exactly the wrong days. He leaked corporate secrets just as the opening bell sounded on the world's various stock exchanges. He created compromising pictures, texts, and emails and sent it to girlfriends, boyfriends, spouses, and the law. And he made social media posts that he was certain would embarrass them in the eyes of their new employer. Some of those people vanished, and Bug figured that was the result of those posts coming to the attention of Rafael Santoro. He did a lot of damage. He ended careers, businesses, fortunes, and lives. He made it hurt. But he did not find Rafael Santoro or Kuga. Not yet. Not yet. Chapter 45. Forested area, approximately 3,800 yards from the Blue Diamond training camp, Caddo Mills, Texas. The sniper was invisible, an angel of death hidden within the shadows of a massive pine tree, lost in the great ocean that was the forest. The rifle rested on a sturdy limb, and the sniper was covered in cut pine boughs and wore a camouflage hood and balaclava, with grease paint over any inch of exposed skin, unseen and silent. The rifle's scope moved without hurry from one face to the next. The crosshairs drifted over the recruiter's smiling face, then the man doing the pat-downs. It moved on to the sentries, and then to the two big men. First, the tall white man, and last, the older black man. Each time, the crosshairs froze over their hearts. At that distance, headshots were possible for a sniper of this skill level, but with the sheer destructive power of the copper-jacketed rounds, a center-mass body shot would be both lethal and easier to guarantee. A voice spoke quietly in the sniper's ear.
"Do you have them?"
"Yes,"
murmured Bell.
"I have them."
Chapter 46. Japanese icebreaker Nobu Shirase, AGB 5003, near East Ongul Island, Queen Maud Land, Antarctica. The ship punched through a crust of ice that was far thinner than it should have been. That had become the routine, even here at the bottom of the world. Captain Hanzo sipped his tea and peered gloomily out at the brilliant blue sky, the flawless blue-white ice, the calm waves, and hated it all. He was old enough to remember first coming to these waters back in the late 1990s when the ice sheets seemed too vast, too dense, too ancient to be vulnerable to the stupidity and careless cruelty of man. Now he was watching a continent die, seeing it melt away as the waters rose and the air grew warmer. He personally wished he could get every fool who denied the realities of climate change and force them to work for a full year down here, force them to see the damage being done to the planet, to his cold world down here.
He kept such thoughts to himself. He was 18 months from retirement and did not want to go out on a psychiatric discharge. His wife was counting on a full pension and the invitations to all those fancy dinners. She also liked the extra money waiting from lecture tours on sailing the Antarctic that would come once he was a civilian. The same had happened to her father, who'd died well off and a very happy man. Hanzo, however, was not happy. The Shirase was not happy either. Hanzo knew that ships had souls, had memories. They were alive, and he knew that his ship was grieving for a planet out of balance with its natural order. Those were his thoughts when one of his crewmen cut through the morning air with a yell. Suddenly a lot of men were bellowing. Feet thudded up and down ladders and along the deck as a knot of sailors clustered together by a section of the port bow rail, all of them pointing to something in the water. Before Hanzo could demand an explanation, a petty officer dashed onto the bridge.
"Captain, we've spotted a lifeboat a mile 3 points off the port bow," said the petty officer excitedly. "There are survivors in it."
"Is it from the Hakudul Maru?" demanded the captain.
"I think it is, sir."
Hanzo immediately gave the orders for heave to and to have a pair of his boats swayed down and lowered. The Hakudo Maru was a scientific vessel that had been sent from Tokyo a few months ago to study the release of ancient bacteria from melting ice. It was part of a joint venture initiated a few years ago after research teams had found and revived an 8-million-year-old bacterium that had been dormant in the Mullins and Beacon Valleys of the icy continent. Since then, other bacteria had been discovered, and the growing fear was that these prehistoric biologicals could pose a serious threat once ocean currents moved them around the globe. The Hakudo Maru's task was to catch random fish and study them for the presence of unknown bacteria and viruses. However, 10 days ago, the Hakudo Maru went missing during a particularly aggressive storm, and the high winds made search efforts difficult. No trace of the ship had yet been found. It was believed that the high winds likely drove the vessel into the path of some massive icebergs that had recently calved from the dwindling ice sheet. One of the new icebergs was estimated to be 750 million tons, nearly as big as A68, the trillion-ton supergiant that broke from the Larsen C ice shelf back in 2020. On a dark night, with a mighty storm blowing and the ocean filled with killer ice islands, a small research vessel would have had no chance. But now, a lifeboat? And hundreds of miles from where the Hakudo Maru was believed to have sunk? This was amazing. The thought of it lifted Hanzo's heart. He called for his jacket and ran on deck. Everyone crowded the rail, watching as two shallow-draft rubber rescue boats zipped across the water at high speed. A lieutenant handed Hanzo a pair of binoculars, and he used them to study the operation. There were three men in the boat, each wearing a heavy coat, gloves, and a balaclava against the cold. The coats were unusually bulky, and Hanzo figured they were wearing more than one. How else could they have survived so long in an open boat down here in the coldest place on Earth? However, as the rescue team came alongside, the men were able to catch ropes and make them fast to their cleats on their own boat. That was promising.
"They must have been able to bring food with them," said the lieutenant. "They don't move like dying men."
"Let us pray you're correct," said Hanzo.
20 minutes later, the boats had returned and the three survivors were helped aboard. Despite having been able to secure the ropes, it was clear they were in bad shape. Sailors had to support them to keep the men from collapsing on the deck.
"Thank you, sir,"
said one of them quickly, and he repeated the phrase over and over again. He, like the others, was Japanese. They all looked to be in their 30s. None of them looked much like scientists, but then again, there were a lot of people aboard a vessel. Men as rugged and hardy as these were likely engine room specialists or equipment engineers. The other two seemed incapable of speech and just shivered, heads lolling.
"Take them below," ordered the captain. "Call the doctor."
The crew helped the men down to the sick bay. Hanzo lingered on the deck for a while, watching as his people hooked onto the lifeboat and hauled it, dripping, onto the deck. He lit his pipe and puffed until the tobacco was burning smoothly, then clamped the stem between his teeth, watching his men work. They were a good, reliable crew. Hardier than most, because work in this kind of extreme weather conditions was not for the average seaman. It required toughness of physical and moral fiber, a toughness of spirit. And not merely tough, but practical, uncomplaining, and good-natured. The kind of sailors who took to this work because it was so difficult. He loved them all. "Captain," called his petty officer,
"I think you should come and look at this."
The man was leaning over the side, pointing to one of the thwarts. The captain leaned over too.
"What is it?"
"Well, sir," said the petty officer, "I don't know what this is."
He reached down and picked up something small and round. It resisted his pull for a moment and then came away with a small puck sound of parting adhesive. The petty officer frowned at it and then handed what was clearly an electronic device to the captain. Hanzo frowned, too.
"I think it's a camera, sir," said the petty officer. "See? There is a lens, and below that, a battery pack. There's a green light. It's still functioning. I think it's on, sir."
The device was about the diameter of a binocular eyepiece and made from hard, black plastic. It was heavy for its size, likely owing to the batteries, which were sealed into a case that had no visible means of opening. He held it up to his head and heard a small, steady electronic pulse.
"It sounds like a remote transmitter," he murmured.
"Sir," said the petty officer, "why would they put a camera on a lifeboat? I mean, if there was a working camera with a transmitter, then why hasn't anyone picked up the signal?"
Hanzo said nothing, but the questions were curious. No more than that, they were troubling.
"I'm going below," he said, and he headed for the hatch through which the rescued sailors had been taken.
He went down the companion ladder and through the ship, the little camera clutched in his hand. As he approached the door to the small sick bay, he suddenly stopped.
"What?"
he said aloud. There, on the outside of the door frame, was another of the cameras. It was identical, and when he touched it, his fingers came away wet. He sniffed them and smelled seawater.
"This makes no sense,"
he thought, and stepped into the sick bay. What he saw made no sense either. The doctor, the nurse, and the six sailors who'd helped the rescued men down here lay sprawled inside. Each of them had small black dots on their foreheads or in the centers of their chests, sometimes more than one. Hanzo felt his heart judder to a stop in his chest, and his whole body went as cold as the icy seas that slapped against the hull. His mind, sharp as it was, slipped a gear as he tried to navigate through the seas of impossibility. All eight of the people in that room were dead. They had all been shot. There hadn't been any noise of gunfire, but there was brass on the floor. There was so little blood, but Hanzo knew that dead people do not bleed. He also realized that the headshots had not exited. There was no blood spatter, only death. The three survivors were gone. Their heavy coats and gloves were on the floor, but they were gone. What had been beneath those bulky coats? He stood where he had stopped, one foot inside the sick bay, one in the hall. Hanzo looked down at the little camera transmitter in his hand.
"God help us," he said.
He did not hear the footfall of the man who stepped up behind him. He barely felt the feather-light pressure of the sound suppressor of the pistol touching the hair over his ear. The shot was a soft thump, which he did hear, though only as a fading afterthought as the .22 slug punched through the bone and began ricocheting around inside his skull, expending its foot-pound of force by destroying his brain utterly, lacking the force to exit the skull. He fell into the sick bay. Captain Hanzo did not hear the screams and yells as the rest of his crew died. There were 53 scientists and 44 crew aboard the Shirase. There were weapons aboard, but the lockers were never opened. The guns and rifles never handed out. There was no time for that. The three fixers swept like a storm through the ship, from stem to stern, deck to deck, killing silently, killing efficiently. They disabled the radio room. Hanzo, who appreciated tough men working at peak efficiency, might have been impressed. He might also have been terrified, because these men moved much too quickly than was reasonable. In instances where a crewman was able to mount some kind of defense, they swept the counterattacks aside. For all the toughness of the sailors aboard, they might as well have been toddlers. It was a massacre. A quick, quiet massacre. In under 9 minutes, all 97 people aboard the Shirase were dead. Interlude 10. Sales presentation via showroom 4 months ago. Mr. Sunday froze the image on the face of Captain Hanzo. The officer had twisted as he fell so that his face was visible, and there was a look of profound surprise stamped on his features. "Now that," crowed Mr. Sunday, "is entertainment." He chuckled as small windows opened on the screen, each one showing the feed from cameras placed throughout the Shirase as the fixers moved through it. Each man had a pouch of the camera transmitters, and they activated as soon as they were pressed to a hard surface. The video feeds showed the slaughter.
97 hostiles taken down, said Mr. Sunday, by 3 enhanced fixers. And ladies and gentlemen, that is an average of 32.3 kills per fixer. No explosives, no airstrikes, no booby traps, small arms only. Oh, and watch this. This is really fun.
He queued up one clip where a petty officer tried to rally a group of men on the forward deck of the ship as two of the fixers emerged. The sailors had oars, improvised clubs, and knives, and there were enough of them that sheer weight of numbers should have carried the fight. The fixers stood back to back, each holding 2 .22 automatic pistols with 10-shot magazines, 40 total shots without reloading. 18 men charged at them, circling them, trying to crush them in a brutal rugby scrum. The fixers began moving in a slow circle, firing and firing. The attackers came at them, and the fixers had a target-rich environment. Their hands were rock steady, and they emptied their guns into the ring of sailors. Only one sailor, the chief petty officer, made it all the way through the storm of lead and managed to strike a fixer across the jaw with a 3-foot length of pipe. The blow whipped the fixer's head to one side, tearing open the balaclava and ripping a red gash along his jawline. Blood splashed out. However, the fixer neither cried out nor fell. Instead, he walked up to the petty officer, who was about to swing again, buried the pistol in the man's chest, and fired 3 shots. The petty officer grunted and sank to his knees, swayed there for a moment, and fell over. Mr. Sunday turned to the wall of screens showing the faces of 16 potential customers. Some of those people would have been appalled had they known who else was watching this sales pitch. Some were sworn enemies who had lost loved ones to the attacks of the others. Some were overtly cruel, others merely desperate in fights against enemies they could not hope to defeat in any kind of standard battle.
"These men here are prototypes," said Mr. Sunday. "We expect the first batch of our enhanced private military contractors to be ready to board planes to your locations in under 6 months. Oh, wait, I see we have a question. Let me read it for the group. When did this take place?"
The salesman grinned and looked at his wristwatch.
"Just under 30 minutes ago. If this wasn't in the Antarctic, the bodies wouldn't even be cold yet."
He paused and cocked his head as if listening to a surprising thought.
"As you'll all recall from the prospectus I emailed you, there is the self-cleaning option, and the reason we staged an op on the underbelly of the world is to highlight the logistical complications of extracting this team. I mean, it can be done, but only at great expense and with great risk. Now, since these PMCs are rentals and not heroes of your homeland or cause,
Why would you want to put your standard military assets at risk to recover them? Once the mission is accomplished, be that taking a ship, securing a military installation, a rival corporation's lab, or a target with significance to your particular idealistic or religious stance, the operatives themselves become liabilities if captured or killed, and we, meaning the Kugo organization, do not want prying eyes to play with our toys. He walked to a small table and picked up a satellite phone, punched a coded number, and waited. When the call went through, an image, fed by one of the camera transmitters, showed one of the three fixers.
Ichi, said the man.
Mr. Ichi, said Sunday, have you launched the surveillance drones?
Yes, sir, I will key you into the feed.
Immediately there appeared an aerial view of the Shirase drifting in the ocean current. Thank you, Mr. Ichi. Where are Mr. Nee and Mr. San?
They are below in the engine room, sir.
Excellent, said Mr. Sunday. You have done an excellent job. Please pass along my congratulations on a brilliant performance.
Thank you, sir, said the fixer, giving a short, sharp bow toward the camera. When can we expect extraction?
Instead of answering, Mr. Sunday looked up from the sat phone, raised a small device so that the audience could see it, then he pressed a button. On the screen, the picture of Mr. Ichi vanished. The feed from the drone, however, continued to focus on the ship. The middle section of the Shirase suddenly bulged upward as if the whole craft were made of inflatable rubber. The illusion persisted for a full second, and then a massive fireball burst upward from the part of the ship where the engine room had been a moment before. The blast was massive, tearing the icebreaker in half and flinging pieces of metal, wood, and human flesh high into the air. Mr. Sunday let the video play for a full 15 seconds as debris rained down in what seemed like surreal slow motion. By the time the last bits slapped onto the icy water, both halves of the icebreaker were gone, each slipping beneath the waves to vanish entirely. Mr. Sunday killed the video feed and allowed for silence to settle over his presentation venue. He spent that time looking from one face to another and another. His smile was exactly the same as a Nile crocodile watching a limping gazelle edge down onto the bank for a sip.
Now, my friends, he said softly, I think we can start the bidding at $1 million per unit. Ooh, I see we already have some bids. Nice. I like that enthusiasm. Another bidder? And another? Very, very nice.
Chapter 47 Blue Diamond Training Camp, Caddo Mills, Texas. Inside the building, they passed a room with an open door, and Bunny caught a brief glance of a man in what looked like the hydraulic power loader from the movie Aliens. A sturdy exoskeleton that gave the man a strange, almost crustacean appearance, with enormous arms that had large pincers. Bunny lingered long enough to see the exosuit's driver swing around and point one pincer at a wall. Bunny realized with a start that instead of actual pincers, the two prongs at the end of the arm were, in fact, gun barrels. Large bore, nearly as big as an M242 Bushmaster, but the overall barrel length was shorter. The recoil from a weapon like that would put any soldier, no matter how burly, flat on his ass, and it explained the heavy structure of the exoskeleton. It was, he realized, a short-barreled Bushmaster that could chase opponents. The sight of it sent a chill through him. He tapped Top's arm and got a nod. He'd seen it too. Saxon led them through another doorway into the main gymnasium. The room was big, with a floor painted out for basketball. The paint was faded and scuffed and mostly covered by exercise mats and racks and benches for weights, and a row of speed bags and a dozen heavy bags hung from chains. Along one wall were racks of training weapons.